our project's been involved with 9 of the 13 DNA exonerations that we've had in Florida since 2001, and we're going to talk about some of them soon. There's been 290 DNA exonerations nationwide, and that's a lot. You know, and some people will say, well, 290 is a lot. It's obviously bad for those people, but that's not a lot compared to the number of cases that go through the criminal justice system, right? We have thousands of cases every month that go through the criminal justice system in Florida, probably millions all over the country in a year, and you only have 290 DNA exonerations? Well, my response to that is that we've only begun to scratch the surface, and we may never truly be able to understand how many people are innocent in prison. Some estimates say it was as little as 0.5%, even up to 5%, even 10%. 0.5% of 100,000 people in prison is a lot of people. And that's in Florida. We have over 100,000 people in our prison system. So it's a huge problem. And the thing that I want you all to understand, and I'll talk about this a little more, is that DNA testing, we do mostly DNA testing cases, and our innocence movement has been propelled by DNA testing, right? Before, it was very difficult to exonerate people for all sorts of reasons, mostly because the criminal justice system was plagued by a myth or an overarching guiding principle of infallibility. You know, they were in denial about the problems with the system, and it wasn't until DNA came along, because it's a very exacting science, that it started to change how we viewed the system. But DNA is only really a component of about 10% of cases. But what about the other 90% of cases, right? The same things that cause wrongful convictions in those 10% of cases where we can do DNA testing cause it in the other 90%, which is the vast majority of cases where people have viable claims of innocence. And we'll talk about that too. Now, we do all this litigation. We work from Key West to, we have statewide practice. We work from Key West all the way to Pensacola, and you know, we're still trying to find a few of those Key West cases so we can spend some time down there. And we haven't found one yet, unfortunately. I guess they don't have much more than DUIs and things like that down there from people drinking too much. But we have a statewide practice, and we have about 4 to 5 dozen cases that we're working on at any given time, really with a staff of 2.5 lawyers and an intake coordinator who reviews all of our cases and deals with all the mail and the screening of cases and our cadre of student interns. And it's a lot of work. You know, some of these cases we work on for 4 or 5 years, you know? I mean, it's a long time. It's incredibly rewarding in that respect when you open a letter like we did with Derek Williams, whom some of you may know about. He was exonerated here out of Bradenton in 2011, last April. We opened his letter from his sister from his sister-in-law in 2006. It is my first week at the project, and I opened the letter, and I didn't think much of it, but you know, we sent him a screening questionnaire, and from that point started a 4 to 5 year process of investigating and, you know, and really trying to figure out what we could do in this case until we actually found some evidence to test, and we'll talk about that too. We didn't get him exonerated from September 2006 until April 4th, 2011. Now, on the sort of other end of the spectrum, we have James Bain, who you'll see some pictures of in a second. And we found out about his case in May 2009, and he was home for Christmas, right? So those are the two ends of the spectrum. I have colleagues from other parts of the country. Some of my colleagues who have been at this a little longer than I have, and they've been doing this for, they've been working on singular cases for 10 years or more. And there's all sorts of reasons for that, mostly because our criminal justice system is in denial about the fact that we do actually convict innocent people. Now, the great thing about our project is that while pretty much all of our clients have no money, they're indigent, they're in prison, they're untrained in the law and untrained in science, we provide all our legal assistance for free. And it's a point of pride for us. You know, not that there's anything wrong with paid lawyers. I'd probably love to make more money. When you don't have money in the equation, it's a lot easier for us to do our job. And there's a sort of a purity of the mission. And we're able to have these great relationships with our clients because they're just never screwed up by money. And we take it as a moral imperative. You know, without our help, most of these guys would never have been able to get out. You know, they would never had the money to do the DNA testing, never had the money to, you know, find the evidence and with hire investigators, hire experts, never had, you know, people would just ignore them. The courts would ignore them. The evidence holding agencies, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, they would just ignore them. So we provide, we're playing an integral role, a vital role in freeing them and doing it all for free, which we're really proud of. Now, that's really one facet of our work, and the primary facet is finding and freeing those innocent people in Florida's prisons. And, when we get somebody out of prison, it's this sort of wonderful experience. We like to try to focus, keep the focus, not on us. We're just the people who do the work every day in the office that nobody knows about or really should know about. But we want to keep the focus squarely on our clients, because they're the guiding focus, they're the guiding light of our work. It's sometimes easy to lose, sight of, the fact that we have innocent people in prison in our daily lives, and it's often hard to contextualize their experience, to understand what they went through when they were taken from society and wrongfully convicted. So I wanted to do a thought exercise, if we can do that. So you can try to understand and get in, the head or empathize or walk in these guys' shoes to try to understand their experience a little bit. Now, think about when you were 19 or 20 years old. Think about the dreams that you had for the next two or three decades of your life, for your future, and then think about what you actually achieved. The years of equality of education you may have received in college or graduate school, medical school, law school, whatever. And you're probably thinking about your first job and turning all of your skill and training into a successful career. Maybe all the accolades that you receive from your peers for your good works, and maybe all the things, tangible things that you accumulated in your life because of your success. And in this time, you may have met the love of your life, and you may have started a family. You may have watched your children grow and surpass all of your wildest expectations for them. And maybe you were even blessed with grandkids or great-grandkids. And there's so many experiences, so many memories from these formative years of your life. But now imagine that all of those things you've been thinking about right now had never happened. Try to imagine that they're just all unfulfilled and shattered dreams. And this new picture is the loss that's experienced by someone who's wrongfully convicted and incarcerated for many, many decades. They just don't lose their freedom. They lose the dreams for their own future. Those dreams, they become dim. Each one of these guys is a brother, is a father, is an uncle, is a son, in some cases a grandfather. These men and their families, they're victims. And they're victims of circumstance, and they're victims of a broken criminal justice system, and the men and their families are victims of wrongful conviction and incarceration. Yet, despite their loss, all of these guys have taught me and taught many of us so much. They've taught us about persistence and about fortitude, and that's why I wanted to take this moment of our presentation and show you some pictures of them so you can see them. I wish they could all be here to talk to you, because they're much more interesting than I am, but this is the best we can do. They live all over the place, and we can't get them all here. So I wanted to introduce some of them to you so you can hear about some of their cases and see who they are as people. Orlando Boquete was wrongfully convicted of Monroe County rape in the Keys. By the way, we missed that one. We didn't get there in time. He was convicted of a Monroe County rape in 1982. Now, in this case, the victim identified the perpetrator as a bald Latino man with no shirt. It's a pretty limited description. And the police arrived at a convenience store soon after the rape, and they found a group of Latino men. And they looked among the group, and only one was bald and had no shirt, and that was Orlando Boquete. So he was taken in, interrogated, and prosecuted for this crime. It wasn't until 2004 that a court, with the state attorney's cooperation, agreed to DNA testing of the victim's underwear, which excluded Orlando as the perpetrator. And he was represented by the Innocence Project, and he was exonerated in 2006 after 13 years of wrongful incarceration. Now, you're probably thinking, 1982, 2006, Seth, you did your math wrong, okay? I didn't. Orlando Boquete, he had the audacity to escape from his wrongful incarceration. And he lived in the mud and the muck of the Everglades and was on the lam for 10 years before he was rearrested under a false name, and then they did the fingerprints and realized that he was this other person. So when he was exonerated, it was a little bit of a difficulty to try to get them to, you know, they said, well, he's innocent of the rape, but what about the escape, right? It's an independent crime, right? It's very Kafka-esque, if you will. But they worked with us, and we said, oh, he would never have been there. It's attributable to the wrongful conviction, and they vacated everything. Now, even though Orlando was innocent, his legal residency in this country as a Cuban immigrant had lapsed while he was in prison. It just wasn't up to date. So he was taken from the prison, from the court, and immediately detained by ICE, and taken to the Crown Detention Facility in Miami for deportation. Okay, and here he is with his immigration attorney that we were able to get for him, Tal Weiner, and who was able, after many years and a lot of legal wrangling, to finally clear up his immigration status, and now he lives freely in the state of Florida. It's me and Orlando here. Orlando loves to travel and smoke Cuban cigars, and he has dreams of opening his own boxing gym, and he currently lives in the Florida Keys. Now, in the late 1970s, there were a series of rapes in Miami in the area of Bird Road. Is anybody here from Miami originally? No? Yeah? Do you remember the Bird Road rapist? Okay, so women described this rapist as Latino, weighing about 200 pounds, being 6 feet tall, and speaking good English. And one of the victims reported that she saw a man, who ended up being Luis Diaz, at a gas station, and she thought he resembled the rapist. Now, none of you have met Luis here, but if you had, you notice very quickly that we have a problem with the description. Luis, at the time, was only 134 pounds, he was only 5'4", and he didn't speak a lick of English. He still doesn't, he understands a little bit, but can't really communicate with him. Other victims came forward and identified him, and he was convicted of 8 rapes, okay, in 1979. And he was taken away from his family. He left them behind, including his 3 young children. Now, in 2003, when our project started, this case landed in our lap. And we began investigating the case. And with, you see Barry Sheck up there from the Innocence Project in New York, we requested DNA testing. And while they didn't have all the rape kits in all of the cases, they had some. And in the interim, from 1979 to when we started working on the case, 2 of the victims actually came forward and recanted, and they actually vacated those convictions already. So they already had some idea that there was a problem here, that this guy was probably innocent. But that wasn't enough in and of itself to get him out of prison. So we did the DNA testing on 2 of the rape kits that still existed, and lo and behold, it showed that the same person committed both those crimes, but it wasn't Luis Diaz. And we worked with the state attorney's office and got them to understand that, well, he already, you know, vacated these 2, you have these other ones, I think it's fair to say, and you have this bad ID, it's fair to say that Luis is not your guy. And they agreed, and they finally vacated all the convictions. And in 2005, Luis Diaz, in his 60s, after 26 years of wrongful incarceration, was finally released and exonerated. He went into prison as a monster, as the Bird Road rapist, and he came out of prison no longer that monster. He was not the monster they made him out to be. And, you know, this case is very special to me because, you know, I'm sure one of you will end up asking me how I got involved with this project, and I'll just preempt you. I was just a student and I was sort of wayward, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, looking for something interesting to do, and this project popped up. and out of nowhere, and I was like, oh, that would be really great. I want to work on that. And this is the first case I got. First case. Okay, and it's hard. You know, they throw eight rapes in your lap, and I'm like, well, how are we going to get DNA testing on just two of them and get them out of prison for all of them? And I don't think I would have imagined, you know, 3 years after that, that this man would be out of prison, free with his family. His children are grown. He has grandchildren now. His wife is still living. We just had our gala event in Miami last week or 2 weeks ago, and I got to meet him for the first time, you know, almost 10 years later. So it was very exciting for me. In 1981, three men broke into a home in Tampa. They robbed the home. They kidnapped two white victims, one an adult woman and one a 12-year-old child. And they raped both these two female victims. And the victim had described the ringleader of these attacks as a 6-foot-tall person, 200 pounds, and light-complected. Now, Alan Kratzer's photo was put in a photo lineup because he had previously stolen beer from a convenience store and got charged with robbery and spent time in prison for that. And the victims identified him as that perpetrator who raped both of them, the ringleader, who raped both of them and had a shotgun. Now at the time, again, we're gonna create a theme here, Alan was only 5'5", and he still is maybe 5'5", 5'6", 130 pounds, and as he would tell you, I ain't ever been light-skinned, okay? And you'll see a picture of him in a second. Okay. Nevertheless, he was convicted at trial, and he was sentenced to 130 years in prison. 130 years. He had a whole bunch of things they charged him with. You know, 2 counts of this, 3 counts of that, 4 counts of that, 130 years. He left behind his siblings, his brother who went to prison, his sister who got addicted to crack, and his mother, who you see here, who died of cancer in his 20th year of wrongful incarceration before he got out. Now, Alan fought like hell to get out. He wrote everybody, anybody who would listen. When he saw other people getting out through DNA testing, he would write the reporters who would write about those stories and say, can you get me in touch with the lawyers who represented these people? He would write anybody. One of his letters landed at the Innocence Project in New York, and an intrepid young student opened it and said, hey, I think there's something here. And from that point, began investigating it, much like every other case, and within 3 years, they were able to get DNA testing on some evidence. Now, most of the evidence in this case was destroyed. And this is 22 years or 20 years after he was convicted already. And they kept saying, there's no evidence, we don't have any. And finally, the investigator got a gentleman from the evidence holding agency to think a little harder. And he said, is there anywhere else you think it could be? And he said, well, you know it's bad when they say, well, there is this filing cabinet downstairs that's been sitting there, slated to be thrown away, and nobody's thrown it away. So let me go check there. I doubt it's there, but let me go check. And they open the file cabinet, and they go through, and they find a folder with the case number on it. And in that folder were stapled to it were 5 microscopic slides from the smears made from the vaginal swabs from those rape kits. Okay? This is like, as Alan says, it's God's hand, right? I mean, it's amazing. And this is the evidence that led to his freedom. They tested that, and it showed that on both the slides from the both victims that it was from the same person. He was not that person. He was not the person. So after 24 years, 6 months, 13 days, and 4 hours, he was finally exonerated in 2006. Now, Alan successfully achieved compensation from the state of Florida, making him one of only 4 DNA exonerees to be compensated by the state. And he's put that money to good use. Here he is signing his mortgage for his house, buying his first home, his only home. And he's also been an avid traveler. Here he is in Washington, D.C., trying to visit President Obama. And he has gone all over the country, even to the West Coast. This is his first time seeing the Pacific Ocean at Shark's Tooth Cove on the California coast. And there he is again. He's loving life. So Alan lives in Tallahassee. And he spends his time working with at-risk kids. And most importantly, he's one of our greatest advocates for the cause of innocence. He goes around speaking to anybody who will hear about his experience, and he's just very compelling. And he is very intent on making sure that what happened to him does not happen to anyone in the future. Now, in 1986, a migrant farm worker named Juan Melendez was convicted and sentenced to death for a 1984 murder in Polk County. He was convicted based on the testimony of two completely uncredible witnesses. Now, it wasn't until years later that they discovered evidence from in the prosecutor's file that actually showed that the prosecutors knew that someone else had confessed to the crime. They had an actual taped confession. It was sitting in the prosecutor's file. He never turned it over to the defense. Based on this evidence, Juan Melendez's conviction was overturned, and he was released from prison, from death row, as a free man, and exonerated in 2002 after 18 years of wrongful conviction and incarceration on Florida's death row. Now, Juan's case provides a very important lesson for all of us. As I said, very few cases are DNA cases. There's a lot more non-DNA cases. The problem is that for all the good work that we've done at the Innocence Project of Florida, when people come forward with non-DNA evidence, the prosecutors often say, well, it's not DNA, right? It's much, much harder now because of DNA to have prosecutors and judges take notice of equally good non-DNA evidence of actual innocence. But fortunately for Juan, he was able to get exonerated. And if he wasn't, he would have died. He would have been executed by the state of Florida, an innocent man. Now, Juan travels all over the country and is one of the foremost exoneree advocates for abolition of the death penalty. Here he is. This is the front cover of his documentary that was made about him. He was instrumental in the abolition of the death penalty in New Mexico and Connecticut, which Connecticut just happened a few months ago. And he's been to Tallahassee to share his story. And he's just a very compelling advocate. He's a Puerto Rican immigrant who was just here as a farm worker who's was just sent to prison, has life taken away from him. But since he's been exonerated, he actually got to go back to Puerto Rico and see his family and see his mother, which was really important to him. And he lives in New Mexico now with his girlfriend, and he just travels all over the world talking about how we need to get rid of the death penalty because there's too much of a risk of executing innocent people just like him. Now, in 1992, a white woman was abducted from in front of her home, taken to an orange grove and raped right up the road here in Palmetto, Florida, Manatee County. And although she identified her attacker as being only 5'6", she identified Derek Williams, who was almost 6 feet tall, out of a photo lineup that contained two photos of Derek. Two photos of him. And despite having numerous alibi witnesses who all testified that he was at a family barbecue at the time of the rape, Derek was convicted in 1993 and sentenced to life in prison. He left behind, when he went to prison, a big family, a big supportive family, including his son, who was only about, I think, 10 at the time. In 2006, as I told you before, he wrote our project and we worked up the case. Now, what's most interesting about this case is that the folks down in Manatee County, the sheriff's office, they were telling us this is why it took so long. They were telling us for years and years and years that there's no evidence, it's all destroyed. We said, where's the proof? Show us the proof. They kept saying, no, it's destroyed, it's destroyed, it's destroyed. So finally we sued them. This is what we do, we just sue you. And we sued them, and then they finally like, oh, we have proof. And we found out that evidence from our case, from Derek's case, was destroyed, but they also summarily incinerated 4,000 cases worth of physical evidence. 4,000. They just decided that we want to get rid of a whole evidence vault because, okay? Now, what's important about this is there was a law in Florida, and there still is, at the time of the incineration in 2003, only a few years before we got a hold of the case, that said they had to keep all evidence until the expiration of that person's sentence. So they not only, did it in a callous way, but they violated the law. Luckily for Derek, a T-shirt left behind by the perpetrator was not at the sheriff's office, but rather it was at the clerk of court. And we were able to get our hands, not our hands, but our analysts' hands on that evidence through an order from the court to do DNA testing. And what we were able to find was that there was sweat and skin cells in the underarm and collar area of the T-shirt, the wearer areas of the T-shirt, if you will. And when we DNA tested those areas, what we found is that there was DNA from a male there, and it wasn't Derek Williams' DNA. So we filed. We thought, okay, we got some good evidence. You know, we go to the prosecutor. We say, hey, work with us. Didn't work with us, right? We filed, and it took us about a year and a half of litigation, and we had a full-blown hearing, experts and witnesses. We proved that they unlawfully destroyed the evidence, and there was a little bit of a cover-up. And we got an order from the judge saying Derek Williams was wrongfully convicted, he was misidentified, and he deserves a new trial. And by the way, they violated the law in destroying the evidence. And from that point, just a week later, they dropped the charges, and Derek was exonerated. So on April 4th, 2011, just over a year ago, we walked Derek, now exonerated and free, out of Hardy Correctional Institution over in Bowling Green, inland here. And he had spent 18 years wrongfully incarcerated. And he was greeted by 11 carloads of his wonderful family, and you can see them here, getting really excited to see him. And you know, they were screaming, "Derek, Derek, Derek!" It was getting louder and louder as we got closer. And it was, you know, Derek was holding on to us, and he was crying, and he didn't really know what to do. And then, you know, here they are. And then when we got close, then he knew what to do, right? We had to push him, and he was embraced by his loving family. And, you know, Derek's case, I think, really demonstrates the key role that our project plays. We're lawyers and advocates first, obviously. That's our primary role. But while these guys had most of their lives taken from them, we're able to restore them to freedom and reunite them with their families. Here's Derek with his son, the older gentleman there, who was only a boy when he was convicted. And here he is holding his grandson for the first time as a free man. It's his grandson, right? He's not grown up with his grandfather. Now, there's also a bond of shared experience between exonerees. And if you look on the left here, and we'll talk about James Bain in a second, but that's James Bain, who we got out of prison in 2009. And he said to us when we got him out, he said, I want to experience this from the other side. You know, I want to go and give support to other guys who are coming out so they know that I'm there for them, you know. And so we picked him up on the way down, and he was very excited to be there, and him and Derek now have this sort of wonderful relationship. And Derek works full-time at Honeycomb Corporation, and he still resides, amazingly, in Manatee County. I don't know why he wouldn't leave, but he still resides in Manatee County, and he's married to his longtime fiance, Yvonne. In 1982, and again in 1984, after a retrial, Wilton Dedge was convicted of raping a Brevard County woman based on her identification of him as the attacker. He was convicted based on the testimony of a jailhouse informant, who was notorious, and the testimony of a scent-tracking dog handler named John Preston. This is Wilton when he was picked up. Now, the victim said her attacker was 6 feet tall. You're going to see a pattern here. 6 feet tall, 160 pounds, and he was big and muscular. Now, Wilton was, and he still is, only 5'5", 125 pounds, and he may be like the most petite man ever. In the mid-1990s, before there was even a DNA testing law in Florida, Wilton was inundating the court and writing to anybody he could saying, I want this DNA testing. And he wanted testing on hairs and the rape kit evidence from his case. And he actually prevailed. He was able to get that testing. The Innocence Project took his case. And in 2004, he was exonerated after 22 years of wrongful incarceration after DNA testing of their rape kit showed that he was innocent. Had anybody seen the film After Innocence here? You should say it's a really great documentary about the whole process of exoneration and what happens after you're proven innocent. And Wilton is one of the four or five exonerees that they profile in the movie. So he's a star. He's a movie star. Wilton achieved compensation from the state of Florida. He was the first DNA exoneree to get that in 2005 with the help of Sandy Dallenberg, who's a former president of Florida State University and the American Bar Association. And he enjoys traveling, like most of these guys do, riding his motorcycles. And he's really good friends with Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, so he tends to go to a lot of Pearl Jam concerts all over the country. And like some of these guys, I don't know why they do this, but he stayed in Brevard County and he purchased a bar, and now he runs a bar, and a biker bar in Brevard County. So we wish he would leave and get away from those folks, but there he is. Now, James Bain was convicted, you'll gasp, in 1974. Okay? He was convicted of abducting and raping a young boy in Polk County, Florida. Now, at the time, he was only 19 years old when he was sent to prison for a life sentence for capital sexual battery. Now, for years, James, he wrote handwritten motions. You know, he didn't know anything about the law. He was begging the courts to give him DNA testing in his case. Now, after Florida passed their DNA testing law in 2001, from that time until about 2007, he applied not once, not twice, not three times, not four times, but five times to the court for DNA testing. Now, he was still in prison, right? So obviously, they didn't grant him the DNA testing every single time. And it wasn't until our project, we just happened upon his case. He never wrote to us. I read the law reporters every week when new cases come out, because I'm a nerd like that, I guess. And I read the law reporters, and there was a case about him. And I was about to go on vacation. I was in the airport, and I was reading them, and I called the office and said, "You got to get on this case. Make it happen. Make something happen before I get back from my 2-week vacation." And I came back. They had already, read everything, and then we were ready to, jump in the case and file a motion. We called him up and said, "Mr. Bain, we have read about your case. Would you like our help?" And he said, "Yes." And we quickly helped him. That was May 2009. July, we filed our motion. October, we got to testing. And on December 9th, 2009, we released our DNA results and demanded that he needed to come home. Now, right before Christmas, on December 17th, 2009, after 35 years of wrongful imprisonment, 35 years of wrongful incarceration, for a rape he didn't commit, James was exonerated and freed from prison. He was met by his loving sisters, and one of whom is his twin sister, and his huge family. And he went into prison at 19 and came out the age of 54. Now, his case garnered all kinds of international attention because he was the longest... his wrongful incarceration was the longest out of any DNA exoneree anywhere in the country, in the world, anywhere. But he also garnered a lot of attention because of his wonderful smile. He's just, people look at him and they just can't get enough of him. Now, after 35 years, a lot had changed for James. The world that he knew when he went into prison was just not this. It was different when he got out. It was completely and utterly different. And here he is using a cell phone for the first time so he can call his mother, who was ill that day, who couldn't come to his exoneration. She had to be dragged out of the courtroom screaming on that day in 1974 when he was convicted. She couldn't believe it. But on this day, she was the happiest mother ever. Now, Jamie is somewhat of a superstar in Germany. Why Germany, I don't know, but the Germans love Jamie. And he's been there twice to do like a whirlwind media tour. They even found him to be one of the most interesting people of 2010. And I went with him to Germany in 2010. And all he wanted to do, he's a big history buff. When he was in prison, he would collect news clippings when famous people would die, and he called them his artifacts, and it's how he kept up with what was going on in the world. And being a history buff, he wanted to go see a concentration camp. And you know, it was sort of this surreal experience. It was cold, and we're all there. And here we are at the place of probably the most well-known and most widespread wrongful incarceration and genocide, right? And here I am, and here he is. Here I am with this gentleman who has spent longer than any person in America in prison for a crime they didn't commit that we know of. And so it was kind of a surreal experience and a sobering one for all of us, and I'm glad I got to do that with Jamie, especially considering I come from a family of Holocaust survivors. Besides traveling, Jamie enjoys playing chess. I would ask him, how long have you been playing chess? And he would say 35 years. So the whole time he was in prison. And he enjoys spending time with his family. He's married his wife, Majaline, and her daughter. And I'm proud to announce that just this March, so 2 months ago, Jamie and his wife had a baby. So, you know, again, it's at times like the birth of James Jr. that we at Innocence Project of Florida realize that the help we give these guys gives them more than just their freedom. James is a dedicated advocate for raising awareness about wrongful convictions, and he's just a wonderful person. We love them all, but he's just so easy to work with, and he's just wonderful. And we hope he has a good rest of his life because he had most of his life taken from him. And lastly, or not lastly, I have one more after this, but William Michael Dillon was convicted in 1981 of a Brevard County murder. Now, his conviction rested heavily, if you can believe this, on the testimony of a legally blind eyewitness. I don't make these things up. They're like totally real. And a legally blind eyewitness, another jailhouse informant, a witness who had a sexual affair with the lead investigator, and the same dog handler who gave false and erroneous testimony in Wilton Dedge's case. Just the same year. Now, he was sentenced to life and sent to prison at only 21, where he was sexually assaulted in his first week in prison. Now, in 2004, Bill heard about Wilton Dedge, we've already talked about it. He heard that he was exonerated, and through the media reporting, found out that here's this guy, he has all the same elements as me. He has a dog handler, he has a horrible jailhouse snitch, we're from the same county, maybe there's DNA testing that can help me too. So he wrote his own motion in 2006 asking for testing in his case. And like James Bain, we saw his case in the news. He never wrote to us. And we called him, we said, Mr. Dillon, do you want our help? And he said, yes. And so we helped him. So soon after, our project came on with the local public defender's office, and we obtained DNA testing on a bloody T-shirt that was left behind at the crime scene by the perpetrator. And we didn't know if it was really the perpetrator's T-shirt, but DNA testing showed us that blood on the T-shirt was the victim's blood. So we knew it was connected to the crime. And again, like in Derek Williams' case, we tested the wear areas of the shirt, and we found a DNA profile that was a male profile that didn't match Bill Dillon. We brought this evidence forward, and in 2008, after 27 years of wrongful incarceration for the murder he didn't commit, Bill was finally exonerated. Here he is talking to the press for the first time. Now, getting exonerees compensated in Florida is not an easy thing. We all think that, you know, getting folks compensated, we've taken so much from them, it should be easy. We all should give them a little bit of something. But in Florida, it's like pulling teeth, okay? And we have a law that says you can compensate people, but it has this nasty little provision called a clean hands provision. What that means is that if you've had a felony conviction prior to your wrongful conviction, you can't get compensated, no matter how much time they take from you. So in Bill Dillon's case, he got picked up driving around a car with a bunch of kids in it at the age of 19 in Seminole County. He had some marijuana on him. He'd been drinking. And he had a Quaalude pill on him. And I guess at the time, Quaalude was a certain schedule of a drug that required it was a third-degree felony, which is subject to 5 years in prison. He got 3 years probation. Two years later, while on probation, he's picked up for this murder and wrongfully convicted. Even though he spent 27 years, that Quaalude pill prevented him from getting compensated through the normal means. So instead, he had to go to the legislature with a private bill just for him and beg the legislature to give him money. And after 3 years of trying, this year, just this March, the governor, the legislature finally passed the bill and signed the bill, and he got paid $1.35 million. I don't know if that's enough for 27 years. You all can decide for yourself if that's enough, but that's $50,000 a year for each year of wrongful incarceration. Now, while in prison, Bill learned to play many different instruments and even ran a band program at one of the prisons he was at. He's a very talented musician and songwriter, and he would write music on anything, even toilet paper. And here he is his first day out, first hours out, playing a song. Now, a famous producer, Jim Tullio, who had produced a number of really famous acts out of Chicago, he saw a story about Bill on one of those hour-long crime shows, and he was very intrigued by him and saw him playing guitar and invited him, just thinking he's going to do a nice thing for the guy, invited him to come to Chicago and record some songs. And that chance encounter sort of blossomed into a wonderful writing relationship. And Bill has just released this past year his first full-length album called Black Robes and Lawyers, which is has a number of songs both about his experience and his his feelings in prison, but also about his feelings of renewal and what he wants for his future. So it's you can get it on iTunes or on Amazon. You should check it out. It's really great. There he is playing again. Now, I wanted to talk about these guys. They weren't our clients, but they're DNA exonerees, and they're important because they sort of got this whole ball rolling, and it sort of leads into my discussion, I think, of the other things that our project does. Now, you have Jerry Frank Townsend on the left and Frank Lee Smith on the right, and they're our earliest DNA exonerees from 2000, 2001. And they're interconnected because of who actually did the crimes that they were convicted of. Now, Frank Lee Smith was convicted of a rape murder of a young black woman, a young black girl, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in the early 80s. Now, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a rash of, there was a really serial rapist killings in Broward County, all sort of the same MO, killing young black women or young black girls and raping them, and they didn't know who was doing them. Well, this one, they convicted Frank Lee Smith for it. They had an eyewitness that said it was him that was coming out of the house where the person was raped and murdered. He was sent to death row. Sort of around the same time, they had all these open cases. They had no answers, no leads, and they picked up Jerry Frank Townsend in Miami, and they knew he was from Broward County, and they kind of realized really quickly that Jerry Frank Townsend wasn't the brightest star in the sky. Jerry Frank Townsend had a 50 IQ, okay? It's about as low as it gets, okay? Mentally retarded, it's the whole ball of wax. He couldn't get to here to there without help. Yet they recognize that they have all these open cases that they don't have any leads on. They have a guy that they can maybe manipulate, and they used him to close 8 of those open rape murders up in Fort Lauderdale. Now, as it turned out, because Frank Lee Smith was on death row, he had counsel and great people working for him, and they actually figured out who actually committed the crime, and they got the witness who identified him. They showed her a picture of this guy, and she's like, no, that's the guy. And they took that evidence to the prosecutors, and the court said, no, that's not good enough. We don't find this woman credible. We think her first identification was right. Now, they've been asking for DNA testing and asking and asking and asking and since the 90s, and the court and the prosecutors like, no DNA testing. And in 2000, they finally got DNA test results on the rape kit from the victim in Frank Lee Smith's case, and they found out that Frank Lee Smith didn't do the crime. And in fact, they matched it to a guy named Eddie Lee Mosley, who was in that picture that Frank Lee Smith's investigator showed the Chiquita Lowe, the witness in that case. Chiquita Lowe was right. They should have given credit to her testimony. Eddie Lee Mosley was the rapist and was the murderer. Now, what's important about this case is not that he was exonerated. That's really nice. It would have been really nice for him if he had not died in prison of cancer first. So he died on death row, never getting an opportunity to see his freedom. Now, the way Jerry Frank Townsend fits into this is that when they realized that Frank Lee Smith was innocent, they retested all of Jerry Frank Townsend's evidence as well. And they found that in every single one of the cases, Eddie Lee Mosley had committed those crimes too. So these two guys in prison, while a serial rapist is out raping people. And so this is sort of illustrative, I think, of the dual problem with wrongful conviction and incarceration. Not only are you taking someone out of society who's absolutely innocent, it's a travesty, a miscarriage of justice, you're making them a victim, their family a victim, victimizing the victims of the actual crime, and their families, but you're allowing the person who actually committed the crime, in most cases, to remain on the street, free to prey on society. So it has a dual problem, and it's a horrible thing. Now, all of these guys who are out struggle in different ways, to reintegrate back into society. As you can imagine, it's very difficult to be in prison for all those years and then come out. It's difficult if you're guilty to be in prison and then come out. These guys come out with, in some cases, nowhere to live, in some cases, no family, no job training. They haven't built up Social Security so they can just retire, right? They've been in prison all those years, all those peak earning years. They haven't built skills or gotten education because they've been in prison. And so our project in 2006 recognized that it wasn't enough just to say, hey, we're going to get you out of prison and send you on your way. Okay, it wasn't good enough. We had to do more. And so in 2006, we hired a social worker to be a permanent member of our staff. And in 2007, we created an exoneree emergency fund. And the tandem of those two things has allowed these guys to have somebody who can work with them on every aspect of their life, whether it's job training, whether it's finding the right kind of health care or eye care or dental care, psychological care, pretty much anything. But also giving them a little bit of money to help them put the gas in their car, get to their appointments, pay the doctors, these types of things, so they can really get back on their feet until they've been compensated and then they have more money to be able to function. It's an important part of what we do. It's our holistic approach to this work. But it's only the second part. And the third part, of course, is what we do to change the way we do things to prevent wrongful convictions in the future. And we're working with law enforcement and the courts and the legislature to try to change the way we do eyewitness identifications and change the way we do interrogations to make the practices less coercive and to record the entirety of interrogation so that we can, when we have a confession, we can judge the reliability of the confession because we can see the nature of the interrogation. We're working to keep unreliable jailhouse informants out of trials because they lead to these sorts of things. Jailhouse informants are the leading cause of wrongful convictions in capital cases, right? In capital cases, they're the most important, hardest cases, high-stakes cases. So they get jailhouse informants to shore up the holes in the cases. And yet, in many cases, they get favors for their testimony, and then we know what the result is. We're working to improve compensation laws. So these are the sorts of things we're trying to accomplish, both to make the lives of our clients better, but for those people that haven't gone through the system yet, they hopefully won't have the same experiences as some of our clients have had. So I think I'm over time. So I want to be respectful of your time and answer any of your questions. And I thank you for indulging me. But this is what we do, and I'm so happy to have been here and to talk to you.
Our system is to go from take a question from each side. Oh, you're over there. So let's go ahead, Don. You start out, and then we'll move over to this side.
Hi, I'm Julie Leach. I just had a question about the DNA law, because you mentioned it several times. It seems like when these guys try and get the judge to look at it themselves, they have no luck, and then when you ask, you get luck. So obviously you need an attorney. What are the rules and all about that?
It's actually pretty simple. The same criteria that we use to choose our cases is the same criteria that the court uses to grant DNA testing. But I think that there's a broader problem in the criminal justice system, or really in the justice system overall, is that if you have money, you have a greater ability to be successful and navigate the justice system if you don't, whether it's because you're poor trying to deal with a tax issue or a uncontested divorce or whatever on the civil side, or if you're poor and in prison on the criminal side, it's very, very difficult. And there's so many people in prison in Florida, and there's so many motions filed that the courts are just sort of overwhelmed by it. So they have a hard time, you know, really putting the energy, and I don't think this is right, but I think it's a reality. They have a hard time putting the energy into looking at these things objectively and saying, look, there aren't that many of these DNA testing motions. They deal with the most important issue in the criminal justice system, which is innocence. We need to take them more seriously and give them the most thorough look. I mean, it's remarkable that James Bain had to ask 5 times, and they used every ridiculous procedural excuse. You know, he didn't say the right magic words. He wasn't on time. He wasn't specific enough in his motion. And then we write the motion, and they agree to the testing. Yeah, you can. The way the law works is you can file at any time. We used to have a deadline in it. We got the deadline removed. You can file at any time, and if you you have to meet certain pleading requirements so the court can understand what your case is about. But you know, if you're in prison and you don't, you're James Bain, for example, who only has about a 6th grade education, and maybe is reading on even a lower level. He doesn't know anything about science. Certainly doesn't know anything about the law. You know, and he's just trying to do the best he can. And so it's, a failure on the part of the court system to recognize the realities of the people who are trying to get redress in their courts. And there should be no reason why, when I jump in and write a damn good pleading, mind you, right? I mean, it's a good pleading, but why when we write a pleading, he had everything in his pleading. It just didn't sound as good as ours. You know, he could have, there's no reason why they listen to us and not him.
It seems like a lot of what you're talking about involves multiple problems in terms of law enforcement misconduct, in that you have law enforcement agencies, they lock in on one suspect and then ignore evidence that points to anyone else. Then you have situations of prosecutorial misconduct involving situations where they hide evidence that's favorable to the defense and don't supply it to the defense. And then you have, on the other side, you have incompetence of counsel representing these defendants, because I know I was a county judge for 27 years over on the East Coast. A lot of times, private criminal defense attorneys are forced to handle capital cases, for instance, and they're paid ridiculously small hourly rates to defend these people. And then you get what you pay for in terms of the quality of the representation that they receive. And then we wonder why these cases went through the courts for 20 years or so. I just want to ask one question in terms of the procedural device that you use. Back when I worked for the Attorney General's Office and the Public Defender's Office, I think you used a 3.850 motion under the Rules of Criminal Procedure. Wondered if that was still the device that you use.
Okay, it's not. There's a separate DNA test. They added a new rule right after that, a 3.853.
Okay.
So we have our own mechanism. But just on a few of your points, I mean, I think, you know, I should hire you as my policy director. I mean, you stated a number of issues. I mean, one of them that you talked about that I wanted to touch on is this idea of tunnel vision, okay, which I think what you're really referring to. And I think we all have a tendency, doesn't matter if you're a law enforcement officer or some person who's a lay person doing whatever they're doing in the world, we all have preconceived notions about any given thing. And some people are better than others at assimilating contrary facts, right? And what we've seen in most of these cases is that had folks investigating them, had folks prosecuting them, had even people defending these people who probably thought their clients were guilty when they should have been more discerning, had they shown a little bit more just skepticism about everything and not been so locked in on what their preconceived notion was, they may have been able to properly assimilate those contrary facts and prevented a wrongful conviction in the first place. Now, you talked about bad faith, and obviously there's not a lot we can do to prevent bad faith. We can rectify bad faith acts after they happen. We can give folks better training to prevent them from doing things that are bad. But I think if someone has a design on committing a bad act, then they're going to do that. So I mean, I think it's, you know, incumbent upon the people who run these agencies to make sure the people in them have the proper training and understand that there's consequences for bad acts, both for the people who are on the receiving end of them, but both and also for their jobs. Yeah, that's fine.
We only got a couple
of
mics, so if you just want
I'll take them all.
I know there's been a tremendous amount of research done on the unreliability of eyewitness testimony since the 1960s. And all that stuff is available, but courts have been reluctant to allow expert witnesses in cases to discredit eyewitnesses. And I wondered if all of this DNA kind of exoneration has led to any changes in the willingness of the court to allow expert witnesses to testify about the unreliability of eyewitness testimony?
In certain places, yes. In Florida, no. Okay, so in fairness, Florida uses a majority rule, majority of states that have adopted this rule, which says that it's within the judge's discretion to allow expert testimony on the reliability of an eyewitness identification. Now, when we talk about on the reliability of an eyewitness identification, no expert can come in and say, I'm giving you an opinion that this person was misidentified, because we don't really know. What they can do is talk about the different variables, both ones that are we can control and ones that we can't control, that affect the reliability of an eyewitness identification, determine whether those variables are present, and give the court an understanding of the research that's been done about how that variable, if it's present, affects the reliability. And then it really doesn't go to saying, well, the eyewitness is unreliable or the eyewitness is mistaken, but rather it tells the jury or the judge or the fact finder to what weight to assign to that evidence. You know, well, maybe we shouldn't assign much weight to it because there may be inherent problems with it. Now, we've had a lot of success using this in our cases that we do on the back end, because we're not in front of juries and we're just in front of judges, and they're much less reticent to hear this evidence, and they're interested in it because it's interesting, you know. And there's so many great experts. There's so much phenomenal research out there about both about all these variables, but also about how you prepare lineups, and the way you prepare them can cause a bad identification or can lead to a good identification. And when you bring all this stuff to bear, courts are interested, and they find out that maybe eyewitnesses shouldn't be believed. And I mean, but that's, to be completely honest with you, the biggest impediment to reform is the folks who rely on these eyewitnesses time and time again in cases. Eyewitness identification is both one of the most compelling and also the least reliable form of evidence. And yet it's the bedrock, because it's so compelling, it's one of the bedrocks of criminal investigations and prosecution. So it's very difficult. Like, if I'm going to go into court and try to tell the judge that fingerprints aren't all they're cracked up to be, and they should not be let in because the science is not properly validated, they're going to laugh at me because fingerprints are the central piece of forensic evidence used in criminal law for the last century and a half. But there's science that suggests precisely that. So the court system is behind in that respect.
Any other questions?
You have one right there. Yep.
How do you get funded? Because obviously it takes a lot of money to do what you do.
You know, it does take a lot of money, and you'd be surprised how much we can get done on. We stretch like a dollar into $10, you know, but. We get our funding primarily from private foundations. So there's a handful of foundations that still do criminal justice funding. They're getting fewer and fewer. A few of them were ensnared in the Madoff stuff, and they were like the biggest criminal justice funder in America, the Jet Foundation. One day they're funding, $30 million nationwide. The next day they're closed after Madoff. You know, so we have two federal government grants. Under President Bush's Justice for All Act, one good thing he did, and so which we're super excited about, because the Department of Justice is actually really interested in helping projects like ours do post-conviction innocence work. And we also obviously raise money from private individuals. And this is sort of my one pitch. Jackie, who comes to me, she's our development director, and she, when I walk out of a talk and I don't like tell you to go to our website and you can contribute, she wrings my neck. So I'm telling you that we have a website. We have information back on the table that has our web address on it, and you should go there. There's lots of cool stuff on there in terms of content, but there's also, if you're interested in what we do and you want to help financially, there's a way to contribute as well.
Did the Innocence Project grow out of the OJ trial?
I don't think it grew out of the OJ trial, because I think that Barry Scheck had conceived and sort of created the nascent Innocence Project in New York in 1992, which was before OJ was like 94, I think, right? And but certainly his notoriety, went through the roof after OJ, which helped propel the project into being something that just not a law professor is doing, but now OJ's lawyer is doing. So, but he had the vision for this and it's turned into an international movement.
Are there ever any consequences for people found guilty of prosecutorial misconduct?
I think I'm going to parse your words if I can. No one is found guilty of prosecutorial misconduct because there's no mechanism to find them guilty, right? So it's questionable whether someone who commits prosecutorial misconduct, and it depends how we define that, whether they commit a criminal act. So if they don't commit a criminal act, then there's no mechanism to find them guilty. And in the civil context, in Florida we have unbelievably restrictive sovereign immunity laws, which make it very, very difficult to even bring a civil action. If it's the prosecutors, they have pretty much absolute immunity. In these sorts of things, law enforcement has qualified immunity, which means you need to actually be able to prove that they acted in bad faith. So it's very, very difficult. Very few people, I think out of all the people who have been wrongfully convicted in America, only like two dozen have been successful in lawsuits. So it's a difficult proposition. That's true. I mean, obviously, there's ethical discipline, which frankly, I think is a big deal. If you tell me that you're going to take away my livelihood, that's a big deal, right? But that's not a lot of consolation, I think, for an exoneree. Though, if you can prevent somebody from doing that stuff in the future, that's a good thing too.
We will take one more question.
Thank you. These are pretty horrible crimes that you're mentioning, and I can understand the difficulty with eyewitnesses. And I'm not sure, not being a scientist or a lawyer, what the range of perfection is with DNA testing, but is it required, or is it a legal requirement of every physical kind of crime?
You mean going forward?
Going forward, yeah, presently.
No. Yeah. No. Right, so it's just like anything else. It's DNA is really the gold standard of forensic science. It has the most solid scientific foundation in terms of the individualizing sciences. And when I mean individualizing sciences, I'm talking about those which purport to connect, individual people to crime, either through tire prints or fingerprints or these types of things. Now, it's just, even though it's the most important and has the most solid scientific foundation, it's just one type of forensic tool that these departments have at their disposal. And money's involved. If you go to, there's a sort of ridiculous rule that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement will only allow you to get 5 pieces of evidence tested if you're a law enforcement agency, unless you can demonstrate to them and get a special dispensation due to the extraordinary circumstances. And so it's really a resources issue. They're overworked. They have to contract out. And there's timing issues. So we have cases from the 2000s that are like perfectly good DNA cases, no DNA testing done. That's the 2000s. So, our DNA cases are becoming fewer and far between. They're becoming more complicated. but we still have like 150 of them. You know, so it's. I mean, you would think that they would just peter out because DNA testing would become more prevalent, and it is more prevalent, but it still doesn't happen in every case where it needs to happen.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That was a wonderful presentation. And come back and see us June 1st when we'll have another legal discussion.